Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
So, good morning, everybody. My name is Federica Montagnese. I'm an adult neurologist based in Munich, and I have the honor to chair this year the EAN scientific panel, Muscle and Neuromuscular Junction Disorders. And this month, we will be producing a season of podcasts. It will be in total 4 episodes on the topic differential diagnosis in muscular dystrophies. And today we will start with the first episode on gene mutations and gene variants. And to address this topic, I have the pleasure to have with me Magdalena Mrozek. She is also an adult neurologist who is actually working at the Department of Neurology at the University Hospital in Basel, Switzerland, and has performed research fellowships at the University of Newcastle upon a time and University of Aarhus, Denmark, and has a special interest in the application of high-throughput exome sequencing laboratory methods for clinical diagnostic purposes in the diagnostic of undiagnosed muscular dystrophy patients. Happy to have you, Magdalena. I think we can maybe start our conversation by discussing how the advent of new technologies as next-generation sequencing, bioinformatics, optimized databases, maybe also lower costs, impacted the use that we now have on genetic tests for neuromuscular diseases.
Yes, so in the recent years, we had a chance to live in a very interesting times. So when the high throughput techniques came into the clinics and also to the research, we created a lot of data. And this, of course, enabled better diagnosis of the patient, but also brought some problems regarding interpretation. So it came out that, for example, to interpret if the variant is benign or pathogenic or likely pathogenic, it is not that easy as it used to be. And some big databases were created just to enable to aggregate data from many countries, from people from many different ancestry background. And that is how we are moving forward. Yes, so this was in short.
I see. So how do you think that the clinical data still play an important role in the interpretation of the genetic results? So how would you like the cooperation with the clinician to look like?
Yes, so I think that clinical data are still very important, especially in when we create a lot of genetic data, and often it is very difficult to interpret the pathogenicity. So this is the point where the good phenotyping plays a crucial role. And especially if there are many variants that could play a role, here the cooperation is most crucial, because it's not just about giving the patient list of the variants. It's more about also directing the diagnosis. And this can take place only in a cooperation between clinician and genetist. So sometimes it is crucial that, for example, the genetist who has the molecular results comes back to the clinician, asks some targeted questions, or even gives the list of variants and helps and asks for help in the interpretation. And now we have also, especially in neuromuscular diseases, some additional methods that are not invasive, for example, muscle MRI. And here, if there is some uncertainty between two variants, this can really help to distinguish between two diseases.
Thank you. And also on this aspect of collaboration between clinician and genetics, so what sometimes we struggle with is the phenotype ontology in a way. So we have also specific, let's say, keywords that can help the geneticist also to interpret the genetic results. And there are also some tools like Phenomizer or other similar tools that might help the clinician and the geneticist also to look if what we found is in a way related in a way to the patient's symptoms. What's your opinion about that?
So I think that these tools are very helpful. The problem is that the data are so big now that it's not possible to interpret every single variant, every single phenotype. So if there is any possibility to for standardization of the data, standardization of the filters, I consider it very important.
Okay, so how would you specifically address the problem of interpretation of heterozygous variants in a patient, maybe with a recessive pattern or a variant of unknown significance in a patient, so more specifically nowadays?
Yes, so this is a very interesting question, especially for the symptomatic heterozygous, because it was thought that if we will have better diagnostic methods, we will be able, for example, to identify the second variant, but or some structural variants. And now we have not only exome, but also genome. We are doing trios, we are sequencing the whole families, and still this is the case that we are, for example, not able to identify the second variant. And this is also a good question. So I don't consider this still close. Maybe there will come some new methods, but this is more like a discussion case. So it's also very important for the patients because for the family planning, for the counseling. And at the moment, I would say that it is still work in progress. So, but it is an important issue, and what is unexpected that even with the better diagnostic methods, we still don't have a good answer for it.
I see. So probably you consider these heterozygous variants together with the clinical data and paraclinical data. And if it perfectly fits, then you would probably think of reassessing the either the pathogenicity or reassessing the genetic data after some years to maybe see if something new comes up, but you would not consider the case closed.
Yes, I wouldn't consider the case closed, especially now, because the thing is that a lot of variants, they are changing their classifications over years. We have data from other different populations, from some minorities, and it is important to reassess the data. But on the other hand, the laboratories, they shouldn't be overloaded with the requests of reanalyzing the data. So at the moment, this is not the standard that there is a obligation, legal obligation for laboratory to reassess the data, I don't know, every year. But still, some of the laboratories, they reassess their own data, and especially variant classification, for example, in 5 years. Just to be sure that they are not missing something. And over recent years, a lot of variants, they change their classification, for example, from unknown significance to pathogenic. So in this case, it is crucial to reassess the data.
And how does it work in your laboratory? So do we clinicians need to have a reminder in 5 years' time for our patients to ask again our lab to perform the analysis, or do you have a reminder, and then if something pops up, then we'll communicate with us?
So it depends, because I used to work on a research project where I reassess the data from my own curiosity, but it was a research project. It works very differently in the clinical diagnostics lab. For example, here in Basel, the data are reassessed, let's say, every 5 years. But still, there is nothing like a standard. It's more like a suggestion. As far as I know, in every lab, it works differently.
I see. And maybe if we also come back to the issue of the heterozygous variants, how do you think also that epigenetic factors may play a role in such cases? So maybe there is no need to find a second variant, and epigenetic factors play an important role then in the pathogenicity. What is your opinion about that?
Yes, epigenetics, it is something that we still are progressing to discover, actually, especially in the neuromuscular disorders, because over many years it was thought that epigenetics has a rather minor role in the neuromuscular disorders, and now it is seen that actually even the methylation clocks and methylation levels in some patients were investigated, and there are some differences. And now it is thought that epigenetics factors, for example, methylation, then they can play a role of a modifier in the neuromuscular diseases. But this is a topic that has to be investigated in a bigger cohort.
And it's also difficult to define how to investigate it, so how to collect these data on epigenetics. I think this is one of the major hurdle that we still have. And maybe one other aspect that I also find very important is how to improve the access to these powerful genetic tools also in countries that do not have these technologies. So are you aware of collaborations of possibility for these countries to also access genetic analysis if they don't have these possibilities?
Yes, so over recent years, there were increasing number of collaboration between, like, for example, Western European countries or US and countries of low and middle income. So the problem is that in the low and middle income countries, there is no access to the technology. So the sequencing is not possible to be done there. So as part of this collaboration, the patient's DNA is sent to other countries, sequenced there, and then analyzed, often analyzed also in collaboration with the low and middle income countries. So I consider it very important, especially because in our genetic data, we have mostly data from the European and American populations, and we are missing a lot of data, for example, from some African ancestry population or even from South America. So I think that these projects are very, very important.
And are you talking mostly about research collaborations, or because as far as I know, there are also some international laboratories, at least for some diseases, that are also co-financed by patients' organization, for example, that offer also the possibility of genetic diagnostic tools for low-income countries beyond, in a way, research collaborations.
So yes, mostly I am aware of the research collaboration. I also heard about this diagnostic collaboration, but I don't know the details about it.
And what about, I know that you are also very active in the European Society of Human Genetics, so how these kind of collaborations also help in the advancement and progression of the genetic diagnostics?
European Association of Human Genetics, we do a lot of education about genetics, about standardizing the methods and guidelines, and I am part of the young members of the European Association of Human Genetics. We had a very interesting project as part of a young investigator forum with African Society of Human Genetics. It wasn't directed in the neuromuscular disorders, but mostly in increasing the collaborations between Europe and Africa. And actually, it was a big success because we organized a forum in Cape Town last year, but later progressed to do some webinars online. And I think that these types of collaborations are very important also for the young geneticists, young clinicians, because in the future, this increases the possibility to perform also bigger projects together. And also, as you told, for example, diagnostic projects in cooperation.
Yes, so I think these educational opportunities are really important to inspire also the younger generation to approach the difficult field of genetic diagnostics, and also maybe to learn these skills and then use them in their home countries so that more possibilities are available then and there. And this is something that it's important to share also within the European Association of Neurology as a possibility. I think that is, of course, very difficult to cover all the aspects of genetics in the diagnostic and neuromuscular diseases, but we have touched some of the most important aspects, I think, and interested persons then probably are going to analyze more in depth the aspects that we have only briefly discussed. And I thank you very much for joining this podcast. And I'm happy to meet you then in the upcoming Congress.
Thank you, Federica.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.